We are dealing with an unpredictable volcano spewing gas and ash and some bad information on the Coconut Wireless. This morning, we're talking with Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Anthony of the Hawaii National Guard about its planning efforts to deal with this latest natural disaster. Morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I know you folks have been busy with the Kauai disaster, and I think you still have a team there, and now you're dealing with all this on the Big Island. How are you guys doing?
We're doing okay. Yeah, we've had quite a few natural disasters strike in very quick succession here. So right now, the situation on Kauai has pretty much stabilized. We still have some personnel there, but about a dozen or so who are helping Kauai police with police roadblocks in the affected areas. You know, obviously, the highways are still only semi-passable at this point. And but that particular mission in assistance to Kauai County is kind of winding down. What has been ramping up and is expected to ramp up even more is what we're doing in response to Kilauea.
Well, what can you share with us about the situation on the Big Island? Because there is the concern about having to do mass evacuations with the threat of the lava, you know, advancing. How would we deal with something like that?
Well, we've started a joint task force, and we're starting to do pre-planning with active duty military as well as Hawaii National Guard personnel. We've got a number of elements, including an aviation task force, which is has already been stood up and is doing planning. But the best way, if you really need to evacuate a large number of people, is doing it by ground. I mean, you're only going to do it by sea or by air if you absolutely have to. And, you know, if we have enough warning, we can move, you know, enough people out, a couple hundred people at a time in military convoys. And, you know, again, this takes a lot of advanced planning.
And I know the idea is that we can keep the roads open and make some kind of a lava bridge, that would be the best way. But as far as equipment, do we have enough helicopters to deal with a large evacuation like that if we can't keep those roads open?
In the state of Hawaii, yes. Not with the Hawaii National Guard because, interestingly enough, one of our units, a CH-47 helicopter unit, these are the large rotary wing aircraft that has two rotors on top, and they can carry, you know, a little more than 30 people at a time. All of those for the Hawaii National Guard are actually out of state right now because that unit is in the process of deploying to Afghanistan. But we're very fortunate, though, that we have active duty military partners who also have these kinds of capabilities. And again, we've already started to liaise with the active duty military in terms of what their assets are, what their response times would be, et cetera.
So if need be, we could look to them for support.
Absolutely, yes.
And then as far as then housing people, I don't know what kind of talks you folks have had, you know, at that level with civil defense and with FEMA and with the county. You know, we've got 500 people at the shelters now. If there were to be, you know, double, triple that number, quadruple that number, you know, where does everybody go?
Well, I know that there are some folks from FEMA on the ground who are also planning for contingencies like that. I'm really not a subject matter expert on that particular area, so I really wouldn't want to address it. But, you know, first things first, need to monitor the situation, figure out whether or not an evacuation is warranted, get the people out safely, and then, you know, worry about long-term accommodations after that.
Is there anything you can share with us? I know there was concern about the Puna geothermal venture plant there, and there was some talk about trying to kill those wells. What's the status of that?
My understanding is that they've already had a chance to inject some water into some of those wells in order to keep them cool. The plan is to completely shut them down. And whether or not that's temporary or permanent, that's just something that's going to have to be addressed as the situation unfolds. We really don't know what the future is going to have. Lava could stop, tomorrow, or it could continue to progress and pose a threat to Puno Geothermal. So we just, for the time being, just the plant's been shut down, and there are no plans to restart it at this point.
And there is a concern because, we're seeing now some of the ash, and I'm not sure which way the wind is blowing this morning and where it's headed. But can you talk about the conditions under which the helicopters go up and the dangers for your folks up there? Because, it's not a good thing.
That's actually a real concern. We actually were not able to fly aerial surveys a couple of times last week just because of low cloud cover in the Hilo area. And so that's a limiting factor for helicopters. But put ash into the mix, and that is definitely not something that you want to have helicopters flying near or around. I'm sure that there would be a lot of flight restrictions imposed if you had a tremendous amount of ash emitted, even more than what occurred at Halemaumau yesterday. That's definitely a concern because, ash gets into intakes. You can have a compressor failure, that sort of thing, and that's not a good situation.
And there are the fumes, SO2 fumes, and I know folks were saying, those masks won't protect you from the fumes, but, maybe they'd be useful if you are in an area where there is ash fallout.
Are useful as long as it's certified to filter out sulfur dioxide. They're useful for very short periods of time, but nobody should be using a mask for long-term. If you're in an area where you need a mask, you need to use that mask just for a short period of time.
And get out of there.
And get out of there. Because even our folks, we have what are called weapons of mass destruction civil support teams. We have one from Hawaii and one from Arizona on the ground in Puna measuring the SO2 levels and providing that data to the county at regular intervals throughout the day, every single day. And even those guys who have professional grade military equipment that they're using gas masks, they don't stay in the sulfur dioxide very long. It's a very limited amount of time that those masks can protect you.
And we do have teams out there who have been working very hard, and you do want to spell your people on the ground. We talked earlier, you mentioned that there may be some folks, support folks flying in to help.
Oh, yes. Yeah. In addition to active duty military stationed here in Hawaii, one of the issues that has arisen is that a lot of national and international media has descended to the Big Island to cover the lava flow. And, that media needs to be taken care of in terms of access to the sites, as well as accurate and timely information.
And right, so you want to get the best information out, and you need people to respond to
and
that.
And that's right. And so we've actually put out a call nationwide to have additional public affairs assets flown in.
Okay.
We anticipate we should probably be having additional folks on the ground within days or next week.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. We appreciate you spending time with us and getting the best information out to the people who need it.
My pleasure.
All right, that was Lieutenant Colonel Charles Anthony from the Hawaii National Guard talking about efforts underway to deal with this latest eruptive phase of Kilauea volcano.
Coming up, looking at the link between terrorism and propaganda. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a heroic aviator whose name once rang out in Hawaii after a heroic feat of survival at sea. He was a Navy commander who set out in August of 1925 to do what no one had ever done before, a flight from the U.S. mainland to Hawaii. Remember, this was 2 years before Charles Lindbergh's Atlantic Crossing made him the most famous man on Earth. Our mystery man's flight was no stunt, though. It was an official U.S. Navy mission. As a precaution, the Navy positioned 10 guard ships spaced 200 miles apart between California and Hawaii to refuel or recover the aircraft if necessary. The commander and the crew of his seaplane were forced to ditch in the ocean, and after 10 days at sea with sails rigged from the wings of the plane, they made it to Kauai, and they were met with a hero's welcome. Today, we're looking for that intrepid commander's name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Mission Houses, presenting Mele o Oahu, music of Oahu in stories, hula, and chant, 5:30 p.m. this Saturday. Tickets at missionhouses.org.
Even as terrorism is condemned by governments around the world, and massive efforts made to identify and punish those who practice it, the threat continues to spread, and new terrorists are recruited every day. Christopher Harmon is the co-author of The Terrorist Argument, Modern Advocacy and Propaganda, and a book that explores the way terror groups use communications media, both old and new, to recruit. He's with us in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
We were talking about terrorism and its origins before the show, and you offered what I thought was a very good working definition of terrorism.
There is a good one that we use as a basis for the book. It's from a think tank in the 1970s, and it's that terrorism is the deliberate and systematic murder, maiming, and menacing of the innocent to inspire fear for political ends, which nicely distinguishes it from things like guerrilla warfare, mm-hmm. which can be quite legal and is the basis of some legitimate revolutions. Mm-hmm. Guerrilla warfare being attacks on security forces and authorized armed forces.
The American Revolution being one of many examples, right?
There are quite a few rebellions around the world which we would think of as to be completely legitimate. What distinguishes the terrorists is really that choice, and I've found many cases where we can show they're making a strategic choice to attack the innocent for the shock value it lends to the fight. It broadens the conflict and it gets them more attention. And among the very first students of this are part of the book, of one of the early chapters, the FLN insurgents against the French in Algeria. Mm-hmm. They'd been engaging in guerrilla warfare, and it wasn't getting them very far. Mm-hmm. And in a major conference in 1956, they made a strategic decision to go to terrorism, and it worked.
You see that in Gillo Pontecorvo's great film, The Battle of Algiers.
That is one of the most instructive films ever made on this kind of business. And by the way, modern terrorists after that frequently watched that.
I know.
They watched State of Siege by Costa Gravis, and mm-hmm. they watched The Battle of Algiers by Pontecorvo because it's so instructive tactically.
Those tactics are seemingly increasingly popular in spite of a huge effort to kill this monster. It's spreading.
afraid that since about maybe the Algerian case, or maybe in terms of international air piracy, 1968, from that era onward, we've seen this tactic and strategy used a lot. And there are enough people who've seen it work or made it work, mm-hmm. or enough who believe it could work, so that I'm afraid it's here to stay. It's now an established feature of international relations, and we have to oppose it wherever we can, because it makes a wreck of things like the civil society and rule of law and reasonable politics. But I think you're right. The basis of your question is right. It's effective enough so that it continues to be a tool of a lot of violent groups.
What kept it at bay? You know, I'm thinking now of past centuries in which it was unthinkable. What kept it at bay during those years?
Well, many of the eras had their own campaigns. The most important one is the anarchists in our century, the late 19th century, mm-hmm. early 20th. For a generation, international anarchists were very important. And by the way, in terms of the book, The Terrorist Argument, we track the publications they produced. They mm-hmm. they were prolific in writing pamphlets and producing newspapers and giving orations. And they moved internationally, not unlike the way some of the Salafists do. They were multilingual. They were adept in lots of ways and comfortable as international figures on the world stage. Peter Kropotkin's among those who wrote memoirs. So we discovered a lot of modern terrorists who've done books. Well, that movement was attacked in the kind of way that governments would respond to provocations after all those years. Governments had international conferences to coordinate policing. Mm-hmm. They created some new policing agencies. That's one of the sources of our FBI. In fact, we hadn't anything like that prior to the 1910s. And they began doing scrutiny of things like visas and consular permissions and mm-hmm. such, and getting quite careful about tracking the movement of these international figures abroad. So the anarchists at that time were atheists, most of them, and they favored no government, not a new caliphate. But surprisingly, there's some comparisons to the modern-day terrorists. And both those guys at the end of the 19th and the fellows we deal with in the early 21st were remarkably similar in terms of how they thought about propaganda, how smart they were, and how vocal they were.
These are often highly educated people who should know better by most, you know, contemporary standards, right?
Very much so. The when you look at a magazine like Inspire by Al-Qaeda or Dabiq by ISIS, you're looking at a very sophisticated terrorism tool. They have some of them have done books like Musab al-Suri's important book on the call to global Islamic resistance, mm-hmm. which lays out the strategy for these approaches. If you look at the communist side, you find the same thing, Chris. People like Abimael Guzman in Peru, an important Maoist, he held two doctoral degrees.
Mm-hmm. The thing that's amazing to most civilized people is the degree to which, as you said at the beginning of our discussion, this is the murder of the innocent. This is not killing, you know, uniformed combatants who know, you know, theoretically knew what they were getting into. This is women and children. This is people in a market square. This is people in the World Trade Center. This is just, you know, people who didn't think they had any part in the combat. Do you have to sort of, is it necessary for these people initiating these actions to, in effect, deny the humanity of those they're killing?
Yes, it is. And some of the terror groups have been honest enough to have internal debates about this. The Weathermen, for example, a Marxist-Leninist group in this country, you would remember, went through quite a debate after a major bombing back east. And mm-hmm. they gathered in California for a kind of Western summit. And many of them made it clear that they did not believe in the kinds of tactics they just engaged in, which killed a lot of people. And other groups have shown similar kinds of qualms, and sometimes that's how we get defections. And by the way, in terms of publicity, that's one of the best things governments can use is when someone does defect from these groups, they know the inside, and they're willing to talk about that. So, for example, Sean O'Callaghan's book called The Informer is a terrific book to understand how the Irish Republican Army and Sinn Féin worked. Mm-hmm. And he was also very damaging once he defected. in speaking out against terrorism because he was among those who had the moral qualms you asked about.
Is that the source of the John Ford movie, The Informant?
I don't know.
It's about an Irish Irish terrorist.
There are several very good movies about Irish terrorism and guerrilla warfare, including The Wind in the Barley,
yeah.
Several others in modern days. What I did was spend 10 years reading one of the newspapers that was supportive of the movement. It was published in New York City called The Irish People, and that's the basis for a chapter in the book because I could glean a great deal about what they thought and how they justified violence.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us, and we do want to emphasize you're speaking for yourself and not in any...
I'm an independent scholar. Chris, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure. Christopher Carman is the co-author of The Terrorist Argument, Modern Advocacy and Propaganda. You can learn more about him and his work on our Facebook page, The Conversation. So, area by Kilauea volcano in recent weeks, but it's certainly in the hundreds of billions of dollars. As one real estate broker told Civil Beat, area properties can't be sold and can't be used. There are also long-term losses to Hawaii County's tax base and to its visitor industry. Chad Blair has the story in today's reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat. Chad, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me, Chris?
Chad, unfortunately, I'm not getting you on your headphones. We're going to fix that problem and come back to you. But
okay.
We're going to move on to letters that we got from our listeners. Disruptive technologies. That was the subject of our call-in show yesterday. With the issues of ride-sharing companies disrupting business for traditional taxi companies. The hour flew by, and we had quite a few listeners whose comments did not make it on air. We start with Alan in Waikiki.
If you just sit on Pikoi towards the H1 entrance any given day of the week, you're going to find those cab drivers zipping in and out of of the lanes and going up and cutting off traffic as opposed to being stewards of good ethics on the roads. So they're not even engendering, like, a good opinion of cab drivers. Additionally, I can't tell you how many times I've had to describe how to get to my house. And they use essentially Google Maps to get where they're going. So there's no in-depth road knowledge of the high populated areas.
Lisa from Honolulu wrote in to Talkback with this. I am an Uber driver 3 days a week. This is why I want Bill 35 vetoed or amended. Many people talk about safety. I use my van for Uber, but it is also my private vehicle. I drive my children around daily. I do not want permanent decals on my vehicle. I wouldn't mind being part of a registration for identification, but I do not want to have letters and numbers going across my bumper. In Seattle, Washington, they have a database, and they have a sticker on their windshield to verify they are registered in the database. I think that's more appropriate because I do not want random people showing up to my vehicle thinking I am an Uber when I'm with my children. I take the Uber trade dress off my vehicle when I'm not driving for Uber.
Thanks for your comments. You can always tell us what's on your mind by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This weekend, we saw the entry into the Hawaii market by Lime Bikes. It's an upstart company that uses a technology of dockless bicycles and electric scooters. It's getting a sour reception by the mayor. The city sent a letter warning the company to discontinue putting the vehicles on its streets and sidewalks. We talked with City Council Chairman Ernie Martin on Monday about the issues that he sees with the new service, specifically at Kapi'olani Park, which has stricter trust rules in place about the kinds of commercial activity that is allowed in that area.
it's something that we need to take a look at, especially in Kapi'olani Park, because actually in Kapi'olani Park, there is a prohibition against any type of commercial activity. So, you know, to allow that particular service to be provided there is something definitely we're going to have to take a look at.
Martin says Beaky Bikes, the ride-sharing company, faced opposition installing docking stations in the park. He says it would be an unfair playing field to allow the Lime scooters where Beaky Bikes have been blocked. Lime Bike Government Affairs Director Sam Dreeman talked with us earlier this morning about the pushback on its rollout and the seizure of some 90 of its bikes.
We are in over 60 communities around the country currently operating multimodal fleets, bikes, electric bikes, and electric scooters, aiming to solve first and last mile transportation challenges, help people get around environmentally friendly, carbon-free ways. From the research we've done, we have not found any approval process or permitting process that actually applies to our business or service. And in the discussions we've had with council members, they've been very receptive and supportive to the idea and hoping that this can make a real impact in how people get around. We're looking to continue working with the city on finding a solution, and because we see a real demand here from the short amount of time and the high ridership that since we've been here.
And the council members that you met with?
Council member Trevor Ozawa and council member and transportation chair Joey Manahan.
Okay. And we did talk to Council Chair Ernie Martin, who raised some concern about Kapi'olani Park because of the special trust rules, and Beaky Bikes has been banned from operating there, and there's a concern that your scooters were there over the weekend.
We have reached out to Council Chair Martin to discuss, share who we are and discuss this further, and we'll certainly address any of those issues as they come up.
So the city has seized, I think, about 90 of your scooters. Since you launched this weekend, what's the status at this point? They issued a cease and desist letter, so to speak, a nice one, but they don't want you operating because they believe that this presents a real problem with some of the city ordinances.
Yeah, again, the letter also stated that they weren't able to provide any legal counsel, and we had to do our own legal research. And prior to launching, we did do that legal research, and in our research and our diligence, we did not identify a specific regulation or permit approval process that would apply to our business. We've requested the city to inform us of the specific approval or permit that we would need in order to operate. We have not heard back from them since making that request. So given that, we don't see any barrier to being able to legally operate here.
So absence of any rule, it's wide open.
That's our interpretation. Until we can identify an approval or a permit or regulation that would apply to what we're doing.
Okay, so we see scooters out on the roads and on the sidewalks and in some cases on the bike lanes. Are there plans to bring in the bikes?
It's a good question. You know, we do pride ourselves on being the only company out there that offers multimodal transportation options, bikes, and electric scooters. And in other cities in the country, we do offer all three options. And we see that having multiple options increases overall ridership. It's getting more people out of cars. But for right now, we also know that our scooters are the most popular product. They're our latest product. They're the most innovative. They're what people like enjoy riding the most. And so for right now, we're really focusing on growing the scooters in Honolulu and seeing how they can be a main mode of transportation for people here.
And we've been talking about disruptive technologies, and this technology of dockless vehicles really is what has turned things on its head. You know, really, it's just you've got the Beaky Bikes, which operates with docking stations, across Honolulu, Chinatown, Waikiki. But yours is a little different model.
Yeah, that's right. They are dock free, and that there are a number of things that come with that. You know, we understand there are some gaps to the dock based bike share system. You know, one is cost. It's typically very very expensive for cities to bring this in. There needs to be grants. There need to be sometimes private sponsorship in order to bring a system like that in. We operate – we in the 60-plus communities, we don't require any investment or funding from a city or municipality in order to operate. The other thing is bike share stations are typically can be inconvenient if they're not placed where you're trying to go. And so our dock-free system allows for complete mobility and freedom in where you need to go because you're able to ride to your ultimate destination. And lastly, bike share stations, you know, dock-based systems can't cover an entire community. So some communities are often left without having – you know, being able to enjoy bike share systems. And so we are able to cover previously underserved areas of a community.
And there are some places on the mainland where you have approached universities and colleges. Did you do that here?
We didn't. We started with a limited pilot program in Councilman Ozawa's district. Since launching, though, in just the first 4 or 5 days, we've actually received inquiries from UH. You know, saying that they see this as a real potential benefit to their student population with a shuttle system that might not be completely consistent with their scheduling. And, you know, so we're now looking to work more closely with some our you know, with them on how this can be a part of their community.
Have you talked to someone specifically at UH? Is there a point person?
Not yet. We've received a lot of inbound, but we're still working to figure out who the right person is to talk to there.
Are these students that are emailing you or faculty, or is it the administration that's reaching out?
Thus far, it's been mostly students and faculty.
Okay. So for folks who aren't familiar with your system, how does it operate?
Good question. So it's completely app-based. So you would download the Lime Bike app on Apple Store, Google Play. You create an account as you would Uber or Lyft, and the first thing that pops up is a map. And the map shows icons, and those icons indicate where our scooters are located. So all the scooters have GPS. It allows users to find them easily. It also allows our local operations team to identify them and find the ones that are low battery and recharge them. Once you find it, as a user, you simply scan a QR code with the camera on your phone, and that unlocks the scooter, activates the battery, and you're able to ride where you need to go. And at the end, you park properly, and you end the ride by locking it through the app as well.
And what's the price?
It's $1 to unlock and then 15 cents per minute of riding.
And then what about the issues that this has triggered with the scooters being kind of like left at the BART stations in San Francisco and being in areas where maybe private property owners don't want them, and they create a hazard for people who just, you know, jump on them and then they jump off and then just leave them off on the side?
Yeah, well, first, I think the fact that they are left at, you know, whether it's a train station, a bus station, that shows that these are actually serving a first and last mile need. In fact, a study we done a couple months ago showed that 40% of our rides started or ended near a transit stop. So I think it's important to recognize that there is a first and last mile gap, and our scooters can fill that gap. Secondly, though, we do have a lot of education in the app and on the scooter itself to try and educate users how to properly ride and how to properly park them. So they're meant to be parked on a sidewalk but out of the way of a pedestrian pathway, not in a way that's obstructing ADA accessibility. So not next to a ramp, not in front of a bus stop, not in front of a doorway or entranceway. But they are meant to be parked on a sidewalk or next to a bike rack as well.
Right. So how do you get around people who just ignore your guidelines?
Yeah, that's a challenge. You know, one of the things we're working on is adding some additional functionality into the app where a user could take a picture of a parked scooter and rate the previous person's trip, and we're able to identify who the last user was, and we can reward good behavior or penalize bad behavior. And so we're looking to roll out those sorts of functions to really incentivize good behavior.
And then how do you keep the scooters out of the hands of kids, because you have to be a certain age to rent them, correct?
You do. Yeah, you have to be over 18 for our scooters. And so, you know, when you sign up for our app, and you agree to terms of service that and that state that you are of age, that you're you meet the requirements of the city and state that you're in to ride one of these. But they're also on our scooter themselves. There's education on them that state you must be over 18, and so we're hopeful that that's enough to educate people. But we'll continue to address challenges as they come up.
Could I, let's say, just go down and say, okay, I'm going to rent 5 of these scooters for my friends?
No, you can't. So you can't unlock multiple scooters with one account. It's one user per scooter.
Okay.
Yeah, scooter per user.
I guess I'll put my mom hat on because I just think, they just look like little toys. And I can just see, they're just scattered everywhere. So you just kind of want to, like spank somebody, okay, there's got to be order with this new, upstart company and this system, and how is it all going to mesh?
To work, yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny that you say they're like toys. A lot of the feedback we've been getting is that people actually enjoy – they find it fun. People go out there and they just want to go for a joyride, and they can do that, and this brings them back to that childhood. But at the same time, we do understand that if a city wishes to regulate, we support that. And we actually have model regulations that we've introduced in other cities and with other city officials. We would love to do that with Honolulu officials as well and share what we believe are common sense regulations that would allow the system to exist and to expand and thrive while also allowing the city to control it as it needs.
Okay. At this point, though, the city has seized most of your inventory.
We launched our pilot program with hundreds of scooters out there, so they've reported about 80 or 90, but yet we still have a fleet out there, and again, we're seeing really astounding ridership even still. I mean, over the first 4 or 5 days, we've had over 3,500 trips taken.
How many scooters do you have on island?
We started with in the hundreds. But we adjust that number based on demand and ridership.
So you told me that you expect to get your scooters back today?
That's our goal. I mean, we've reached out to HPD to understand the recovery process, to understand the specific reasoning and the alleged violations that the scooters posed, but we have not heard back yet.
Okay. So we'll see what happens at the end of the day.
We'll see what happens, yeah.
All right. Thanks so much for
joining
us.
Thank you very much.
Sam Dreeman is Lime's Honolulu Government Affairs Manager. Today marks exactly 2 months since Lime Bikes registered to do business in Hawaii. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
There's no solid dollar estimate of the damage done to the Pahoa area by Kilauea volcano in recent weeks, but it's certainly in the hundreds of millions of dollars. As one real estate broker told Civil Beat, area properties can't be sold and can't be used. There are also long-term losses to Hawaii County's tax base and to its visitor industry. Chad Blair has the story in today's reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat. Good morning, Chad.
Hi, Chris. Good morning to you.
So this affects Hawaii County in a lot of areas that aren't really even haven't been calibrated yet, yeah?
Right. This comes, by the way, our story from Jason Armstrong. He's one of two Civil Beat columnists that works on the Big Island, been writing a lot about Pele in the last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. We've been hearing a lot about the physical destruction that's going on, the emotional toll. Jason decided to take a closer look at how much is this going to cost us financially. And you're right, there's no solid figure, but the people that he's talked to, including people in the real estate business, some tax officials, they say it's probably going to be conservatively in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And not just out of what's happened in Leilani Estates, where I believe at least 26 homes, mm-hmm. other structures destroyed. There's going to be concern, as you mentioned, about property taxes, or people are not going to be able to, pay to the county. And there's so many other things that haven't been. You still there, Chris?
Yeah. That property tax benefit to the county goes to zero for all of those homes.
Well, that would be the case, and that's a good chunk of change that the county could really do with, given all that's going on. Think about the round-the-clock staffing, another angle that we haven't looked into. We're talking about not only the National Guard, the Department of Land and Natural Resources, the county officers. They're having to be there 24/7, right? You can't just shut this thing down. The volcano is happening all the time. So that's another factor that's adding up. And tourism, boy, one can't even tell what that might be. There's already been some reports about damage. Although it's kind of interesting, Chris, Jason reports that there's people that may be terrified to go to the Big Island right now because they hear about the volcano. There's other people that want to go to the Big Island because they're drawn to the action. And we've seen some indication that bed and breakfasts are doing better, not in the Puna area, but in places like Waimea and Captain Cook.
Well, you know, Chad, we've both seen reporting from the mainland of the volcano that is downright laughable, you know, people asking us if we're safe on Oahu and things like that. So that kind of misinformation can't be helpful.
No, it's not. And if you're in Pahoa, which is not impacted by this volcano, yes, Leilani Estates is near there, and Pahoa was the target 4 years ago. In fact, there's a lot of Pahoa businesses saying, look, you can still come and visit us. You know, our restaurants, our stores are open. So that miscommunication is definitely having a factor as well.
Well, at some point we'll get a closer dollar estimate, but we know now that it's high, at least, don't we?
Yes, at least in the hundreds of millions. And if you think about it, when Governor Ige asked for disaster relief from President Trump, that was $1.9 million threshold right there. The governor is now indicating that it could be more like $2.9 million.
Thanks very
at
much
least.
For checking in with us, Chad. Every day we bring you a reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat, today featuring political and opinion editor Chad Blair. To read the full story by Jason Armstrong, visit civilbeat.org.
In today's backyard quiz, we asked you about a 20th century aviator. There's a boulevard near Honolulu's Daniel K. Inouye International Airport that bears the name of our mystery man. It's something of a demotion. The entire airport was once named for him, and for good reason. In 1925, he and his U.S. Navy crew had flown their seaplane from California to within 400 miles of Oahu when they ran out of fuel. They managed to sail their jury-rigged craft to 10 miles off Kauai, where a submarine spotted it and escorted the crippled plane into Naviliwili Harbor and into headlines around the world. Before his heroic flight, the pilot had been commanding officer of the Naval Air Station at Pearl Harbor, and on March 21, 1926, the John Rogers Airport was dedicated. So the next time you drive on Rogers Boulevard, think of a forgotten hero of Hawaii aviation.
And Catherine, he wasn't forgotten by everybody. Buck Nicholson was the first person to get the answer correct. He's from Wailuku. Congratulations. He's our backyard quiz winner for today. And that's our quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Career Center, where students can explore possible careers, get localized data, and understand expectations for those careers. Achieve3000.com.
Viruses are little understood. There's even some debate in the scientific community about whether they should be thought of as living organisms. They take on life only when they inhabit a cell, and the recent discovery of a novel virus inhabiting algae in Kaneohe Bay can tell us much about how they work. Christopher Schwartz is a UH Manoa Oceanography graduate student who led the TET-V1 project as part of his doctoral dissertation. We spoke with him earlier this morning.
This was a virus that was isolated from Kaneohe Bay,
mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because it's a very large virus, and it has genes in it that it encodes that make it different from any virus that we've seen before. Particularly, it encodes genes related to sort of energy production, fermentation, that are typically associated with cellular organisms.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a pathway that cells use to create energy from sugars when there isn't oxygen available.
You were telling me that viruses aren't necessarily considered to be a life form?
Exactly. Viruses don't need to actively use energy to maintain themselves like cells do.
Mm-hmm.
In the ocean, these viruses are simply floating through the environment, not actively doing anything until they encounter the host, at which point they hijack the machinery of the host in order to replicate themselves.
Which is what a virus that causes illness does.
Yes.
Inhabit, the body's cells and make us sick?
Exactly. But in the ocean, they actually have an important role other than just being detrimental to the organisms they infect. They help to maintain diversity in the ocean.
How so?
So organisms that start to outcompete other species and start to dominate, it sort of creates a scenario where these viruses can more efficiently spread through that population.
Mm-hmm.
So the viruses act to kill the winner, keeping these otherwise dominant organisms in check so that other species have a chance to thrive as well, which increases the number of species that can actually coexist in a particular environment.
Is the fact that this virus was found in Kaneohe Bay related to the fact that Kaneohe Bay has had its troubles with an imbalance of algae?
I think there's probably a thriving viral community in Kaneohe because it's a nutrient-rich ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of life, a lot of algae that grow due to the high amount of nutrients. So it has become a great place to look for new viruses that are affecting these microbial populations.
How advanced is our understanding of viruses and what they do, what they are?
We're continually learning more about viruses, particularly these giant viruses, which is sort of a term that can be used to describe this virus. We used to consider viruses as being extremely small, much smaller than cellular organisms. But over the past 15 years, we continue to discover viruses that rival the size of bacteria and encode many more genes, allowing viruses to manipulate their hosts in new ways and utilizing different functions than we would typically associate with viruses.
So this is the discussion you were telling me about whether or not they're actually life forms. Once they inhabit a cell, that the nature of that cell changes.
Yes.
And they start acting, do the viruses start acting as if they were alive, or does that make the cell? I mean, it changes the cell, right?
Yeah, they essentially hijack the machinery of the cell and start to create their own proteins related to making new viruses. And in some cases, they need to perhaps supplement the energy production within the cell. For example, this new virus with these fermentation genes may be trying to keep energy flow up high enough to ensure successful replication.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they pretty much take over the cell in order to achieve that goal of making more of themselves. And then they burst the cell and are released again into the environment.
That process you just described sounded as if it might have some beneficial applications.
Yes. It's also important for sort of how it affects how food and nutrients move in the ocean, too. For example, these organisms are being fed upon by larger organisms with that energy moving up the food chain.
Mm-hmm.
But when viruses infect them, they burst open, releasing organic matter that is then fed on by bacteria and decomposed. So it's sort of a part of nutrient cycling in the ocean as well.
Sounds like an essential part.
Yes.
Generating the motion, as it were.
Yeah, that released organic matter definitely supports a whole suite of other organisms specialized mm-hmm. in decomposing organisms in the ocean.
How did you go about isolating this virus, making this discovery in the first place?
So this was part of a rather large effort where I basically grew many different types of phytoplankton from Kaneohe Bay. And then it was a matter of trying to find viruses that infect them. And this was done by collecting seawater that was then concentrated. So concentrating all of the viruses existing in a sample of seawater in Kaneohe and then spiking some into these cultures and seeing, do any of these cultures show signs of infection?
Mm-hmm.
And then if we see signs, we can sort of follow up and then determine whether or not there's a virus there, and then from that stage start to study that virus further.
Sounds as if a process that could be replicated in other areas to make further discoveries. Is that right?
Exactly, yeah. It's still the main way that we isolate it and find new viruses.
When you describe it as an unusually large virus, it's still microscopic, right?
Exactly. Unusually large compared to your average virus in the ocean. And you can sort of relate it to perhaps the width of a human hair. So your average virus, you would need 1,000 of those to span the width of a human hair.
Uh-huh.
And then this virus is 5 times bigger. But there are also larger viruses than this one that have been discovered that are more similar in size to bacterial cells.
They're earning themselves the name of giant viruses.
Exactly. But sort of one of the constraints as far as size goes for viruses is that they can't be larger than the host cell that they infect.
Mm-hmm.
As they replicate, they can only make as many progeny that still fit within that host cell.
Sounds as if there are a great deal more to be discovered in this pathway that you're on.
Exactly. And that's part of what sort of fueled my PhD research was that through new genetic techniques, we've revealed that there's extraordinarily high amount of diversity of viruses in the ocean, but we don't really have any information to go with them other than those gene sequences. So this is sort of an effort to identify what those viruses actually are and who they're infecting so that we can tie that environmental data to the role of these viruses in that environment.
But we do understand that it's an essential role.
Exactly, yeah, and essential for understanding what controls the populations of these very important microbes in the ocean.
Christopher Schwartz is a UH Mono oceanography graduate student who led the TET-V1 project as part of his doctoral dissertation. You can learn more about it on our Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow, we'll get an in-studio visit from blues artist Josh Smith.
And we welcome your feedback. Tell us what you think. Suggest a story idea. Call our talk back line and leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or on Twitter at HI Conversation. This program and all our past ones are available on The Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.